Thank you so much, Asaf. And I feel kind of embarrassed to be on this call because I've been more of a polemicist than a scholar, but and I really appreciate SPME's work. They were one of the things, but I wrote a piece a long time ago called What Fair Witness Requires, which was about the failure of the mainline Protestants to deal with Israel. SPME was one of the first organizations that actually it promoted that piece. And it was very helpful to know that people who were smarter and more diligent than I actually took my work seriously. And it was one of the reasons why I continued to hang in there. And as most of you probably know, I've been a fairly vocal critic of mainline Protestantism's community, their stance on the Arab-Israeli conflict for about 15 years. I started out at an organization called the David Project, which later became the David Project Center for Jewish Leadership. And I was a member of the United Church of Christ, and I was enlisted to essentially fight against BDS in the American mainline. And when I'm talking about the mainline, I'm talking about essentially five churches that were most vocal in their criticism of Israel. And the United Methodist Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Church of Christ, and the Episcopal Church USA. And I don't write as much about these churches as I used to, in part because they no longer have the ability to direct the agenda for discourse in American society that they had even 10 or 15 years ago. Quite frankly, these churches have kind of gone off the cliff in terms of membership and influence. You know, in the early mid-1960s, they had about maybe 25 million members between them. And now, more recently, they probably have less than 18 million members, I know for sure. And the thing is that their percentage as a population of American society has decreased drastically as well. But the thing that was that my work with the mainliners actually prepared me for the work in the evangelical Protestant community, which is much more robust in the United States, largely because I was able to document how the same tactics used to turn the American mainline against Israel are being deployed against other civil society institutions here in the United States. And one of the things that has really bothered me over the past 15 years, and it's become much more pronounced, is that I don't think that there's any, you know, in 1980, President Ronald Reagan asked, you know, are you better off 4 years now than you were 4 years ago? And the question, the formulation that I've been asking myself is American civil society better off than now than it was 15 years ago? And it seems as if everything of all of the institutions that we rely upon to essentially engage in the formation of our families, the buildings, I guess you would call it, and essentially the middle realm institutions that we rely upon to kind of govern ourselves or educate ourselves and formulate our response to the challenges we face as a people have basically gotten worse. Higher education has gotten worse. Journalism has gotten worse. And I think religious life has gotten worse in the United States as well. And so I feel kind of like the owl of Minerva, which is a phrase that I'm stealing from Richard Landis, and I'm sure he got it from somewhere else, is perched on my shoulder over the past few years. And, you know, 10 years ago, I would be speaking to you in anguish and polemical tones about what the mainline churches were doing. But now I can think I can tell you a little bit about what happened and why it happened with a greater sense of understanding. And it's, the problem is that by the time I figured it out, in many respects, I think these churches have one declined substantially, and they've kind of gone on to other things, but that doesn't mean that they're going to stop beating up on Israel. But the interesting thing about these churches, particularly the UCC and the Presbyterian Church, but it, all of them, was is that they, after the Holocaust or in the years after the Holocaust, they or their proceedings basically started to work on issues related to Jewish-Christian relations, and they dealt with the issue of supersessionism. And they understood that the Christian supersessionist attitudes towards the Jewish people played a role in laying the groundwork for the Holocaust in Europe. And so they went from priding themselves for their respect for the Jewish people and their concern for their safety to becoming major purveyors and consumers of rhetoric demonizing the Jewish state and the Jews who supported it. And they went from lamenting the destruction of Jews in Europe and the role Christians played in that destruction to depicting Israel as a singular source of suffering in the Middle East and depicting American Jews who supported Israel as being enemies of democracy and human rights. And one of the primary vehicles for this change was BDS resolutions that were put forward in these churches. And one of the things that I like to tell people is that whether or not the churches actually pass these resolutions, just the fact that they were put on the agenda gave people an opportunity to spew invective at Israel to promote their propaganda. And I think that was really one of the goods that they were hoping to achieve from their perspective, okay? And another thing that they did was that they produced books and materials that problematized Jewish efforts to defend Jewish life, liberty, and property. And one of the interesting things is that there was a book called American Protestantism and the Jewish State that was written in the 1970s by Herzl Fishman. And he documented, he said, look, these churches have a tough time with collective expressions of Jewish identity. And I think the same factor is going on here. And I don't want to say that the supersessionism is necessarily theological. I think I'm going to borrow again a phrase from Richard Landis. I think it's like secular supersessionism. But the story that they told by these churches was that efforts to protect Jewish life was blameworthy, while Palestinian efforts to deprive Israel of its ability to protect the lives and safety and property and sovereignty of its citizens was lamentable but understandable. And the mantra I used to describe this phenomenon was that they basically used theology for the Israeli, sociology for the Palestinians. They would take biblical mandates for justice you shall pursue, direct that at the Israelis, and essentially kind of tell a story about the Palestinians. Well, if you were under occupation, you would engage in terror too. And the history about the peace offers, what happened at Camp David, the Clinton parameters, that type of stuff was just left out of the story. And the overall impact of this messaging was to give license to anti-normalization activists in the West Bank and excite feelings of fear, resentment, and isolation on the part of Israeli and American Jews. And this isn't exactly the opposite of what you would want peacemakers to do. They went around saying they were peacemakers, but instead they engaged in the propaganda war against Israel. And also these statements were marred by, associated with the BDS campaign, were marred by anti-Jewish or anti-Judaic polemics that delegitimized the Jewish state, frightened and antagonized Jews in the United States and Israel. And also essentially lent, aid and comfort to extremists in Palestinian society. And I don't think that these churches started out with hostility towards Jews at first, but it was basically more towards Jewish self-defense and collective expressions of Jewish identity and sovereignty, which in the abstract aren't the same thing as hostility towards Jews, but in the effect they are. And what I have said previously is that these folks like their Jews beleaguered. They can get along fine with Jews who rely on them for protection and assistance and sympathy, but when it comes to Jews who are willing and able to defend themselves, well, then there's a problem, and they will lament their failure to stand with Jews during their time of trial and then condemn them when they are able to defend themselves. And I have two books on my desk that kind of highlight the shift that took place. In the early 1980s, the United Church of Christ, its publishing house called Pilgrim Press, published a book edited by Azriel Eisenberg that was called Witness to the Holocaust. And it's a very powerful text, a compendium of firsthand testimonies about what happened during the Holocaust. But then in 2003, they published another book called Whose Land, Whose Promise? What Christians are not being told about Israel and the Palestinians. If you Google my name and the name of the author, Gary Burdage, you'll see that I've written a lot about that text. And what it did was that it showed to me, and it demonstrates that the front cover of that Whose Land, Whose Promise book shows a young Palestinian boy preparing to throw a rock at an Israeli tank. And in that book, or in the mainline mindset, Jewish victims are valorized, but Jews with power to defend themselves have been anathematized. And so the thing is that the decline that has been taking place since the mid-1960s, the numerical decline, I've written about that, and I've also cited authors who've said, look, these churches have been actually losing influence in American society on it as a percentage of the American population. But up until the 1960s, essentially, they were part of the, they helped maintain and establish the Protestant establishment. And David Hollinger has written in that he's a historian. He says prior to 1960s, if you were in charge of something big and had opportunities to influence the direction of the society, chances are that you grew up in a white Protestant milieu. And people joked about the Episcopalians and Presbyterians being the chosen, frozen chosen. But these and the other mainline churches had the influence necessary to make a good case that they were in fact the chosen people. And they comprised an establishment that helped define what it meant to be an American. And that was one of the things that was kind of documented in Protestant Catholic Jew by, I don't have the author's name off the top of my head, but that was kind of the text that everyone kind of acknowledged. The thing is that these churches are simply not the dominant force in American society that they once were, and they've been superseded. They are, have been actually themselves victims of supersessionism because they've been superseded by the forces of secularism and rationalism that they, ironically enough, deployed in their rivalry with evangelical Protestants of the United States. And the thing is, I used to think that one of the reasons why these churches were dying was that because they embraced BDS. In fact, I think it's the other way around. The reason why these churches embraced the BDS campaign was because they were dying. By attacking Israel, they were differentiating themselves from their longtime rivals in American society, evangelical Protestants, who enjoyed a period of resurgence and newfound influence in the political arena since essentially the late 1970s and early 1980s. Everyone talks about the moral majority coming on the scene in the 1980s with Jerry Falwell, but they also played a significant role in Jimmy Carter's election in 1976 because they thought he was a moral person. He was an evangelical like themselves. Now, in their rivalry with evangelicals, mainliners offer up an ugly caricature of evangelicals as supporting Israel solely for eschatological reasons, for the end time stuff. And they attack Israel to help portray evangelicals as what anthropologist Susan Harding has called the repugnant other. And her writing on this is actually very, very, very helpful because she says that in order to demonstrate that you're on the right side of modernity, oftentimes what you do is you point out a repugnant other that's on the wrong side of modernity and say we're not anything like them. And she's done this, and she's written about this in reference to the evangelicals, and I also think that she's written about this in reference to Israelis who live in the West Bank. That process happens as Israel. And so BDS provided, the campaign provided a lot of, if you'll pardon the expression, goods that mainline Protestants needed that didn't have anything to do with peace in the Middle East. And what they did was is that they, the participation of these churches that in a campaign that delegitimized Israel facilitated Palestinian anti-normalization efforts and antagonized American Jews was not motivated initially by anti-Semitism, but it was instrumental policy that provided goods to these churches that they needed. And one of the things it generated was a lot of publicity for them when they passed these BDS resolutions, particularly the Presbyterian Church USA and the United Church of Christ, they were able to garner a burst of sympathetic coverage that they wouldn't normally have gotten, because the press doesn't go to these churches the way that they used to find out what they were thinking. You know, there's no more Paul Tillichs, there's no more Reinhold Niebuhrs. These are names of people that were mainliners that people listened to. And Paul Tillich came over from Germany, but essentially he was brought into the fold. So what we see at one point during an interview, former President and General Minister John Thomas said that by affirming a BDS resolution in 2015, the church that he used to lead, the United Church of Christ, was joining a much broader coalition to amplify the weight of our action. And on this instance, the UCC was along for the ride and it wasn't steering the boat. And that, you know, clearly that's not how it used to be. They used to be kind of upstream from American culture, and now they're kind of downstream from American culture. And they've been superseded by the forces of secularism and rationalism that, ironically enough, they deployed in their rivalry with evangelical Protestants in the U.S. In his book, An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America, Joseph Bottom describes how the manifestation of post-Protestant ethic has coincided with the collapse of mainline churches from which it sprang. And the way I put it, and I'm riffing off of Joseph Bottom's book, is that the social gospel put forth by Walter Rauschenbusch in the early 1900s has devolved into the social justice movement without the gospel. And the elites who run what's left of the Protestant establishment are now looking on the outside, looking in. And these churches and the people who run them have been supplanted, or more precisely superseded, by a post-Protestant establishment Joseph Bottom describes as having taken control of the credentialing institutions on the American scene. And he describes this as an elect class that embraces a secular worldview that is rooted in the mainline ethos, except it's stripped of its religious component. And this is where the supersessionism comes into play. By sitting in judgment of Israel and in opposition to Israel-loving evangelicals who've been ascended since the 1980s, mainline Protestants are attempting to reaffirm or reestablish their status as the chosen group, uniquely fit to lead the American people into modernity, even as their churches are dying and superseded by post-Protestantism. And so by enlisting in the BDS movement, mainline elites have signaled to the rest of society that they've accepted the tenets of this post-Protestantism, while still maintaining a modicum, but not too much, of religious belief of their own. And their goal is to demonstrate that they're on the right side of the modernity. They want to be one of the cool kids, and BDS helps them do that. And so mainline elites affirm their status as the chosen over against Israel and evangelical Protestants to demonstrate their continued value and relevance to American society, which largely ignores the monocultural level, even as they espouse and impose an ethic these churches helped establish and promulgate. And in his book, The Chosen, The History of an Idea and the Anatomy of an Obsession, Avi Becker writes, "Jews are often rejected because of the will of the others to become the chosen." And I think that's part of what's going on. And there are other things. I don't want to say that this is a univariate explanation, but this is the one that I am most familiar with. But the mainline churches have endured a humiliating loss of status in American society, and these elites have tried to counter this decline in part with BDS activism. And in light of what I told you, it's reasonable to ask, if this is the last gasp of dying churches, why should we worry about what they say? Why not just ignore them? And my first response is that the mainline churches in the anti-Zionist movement can be used to protect other groups in this movement from legitimate charges of extremism and bigotry. They can say, look, we've got the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, and the Episcopalians on our side. You know, how bad can we be if these condign folks are with us? And the churches may not have the institutional muscle they once did, but they do still have a vestige of symbolic power as historic arbiters of right and wrong in American society, even in their twilight. And my second response is that what has happened in the American mainline can shed some light in what has happened in other institutions in American society. And maybe we can deploy and use this information to respond to what's going on in those other institutions. And with that, I'll bring it to a close.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. That's, you know, a very enlightening on a variety of levels, Dexter. And there's a lot of, you know, and thank you for bringing that up. There are several questions that we, you know, we have to tackle. But, you know, Alex, I know is short on time today. So why don't I let Alex first start off with his question. After that, I'll open up the floor to as many questions as we have. Again, people, please, if you're logged in through the computer, all you have to do is raise your virtual hand, or you can type in your question via the chat, and we'll tackle them there as well. So, Alex, let me give you the opportunity for the first question, and we'll continue onward.
Okay, terrific. First of all, let me add my thanks to Asaf's for a great presentation. Very thought-provoking. These are some of the kinds of issues that Asaf and I have written about in a parallel context with respect specifically to Quakers in America and in their institutions like the American Friends Service Committee, and their, which comes from a different Protestant tradition, but which from the period of World War II onward, very much migrated away from a position that was neutral regarding Israel and fairly favorable regarding Jews to positions of overt hostility and something much more closely resembling traditional Protestant supersessionism, an ideology or doctrine that they never really had before in their hundreds of years of history. So this is all very interesting, and I think my question is, you know, whether you think we are in fact in another kind of period of a great awakening. I always tell people that Americans are the most religious people on planet Earth. And I think what we've seen, certainly in the last few months, this religious outpouring, but it's very much moved away from any kind of traditional religion. Traditional, certainly moved away from any emphasis with respect to the gospel and the figure of Jesus, the life of Jesus. So I wonder whether you could talk about what we see now in churches, but also in society as a religious movement.
I think that's a really good question. And I was talking with a friend of mine. I converted from the UCC to Roman Catholicism in large part because I concluded that the churches that the mainline church, particularly the UCC, just didn't have the religious practices I needed to be a responsible husband and father. In his late 40s. That's kind of a weird thing to say, but that's really what it was. And that was kind of my response for the pursuit of maybe not a great awakening, but kind of a modicum of awakening in my own life. And one of the things that I have seen is that I think that some of the Antifa and the BLM activism is in many respects, and is kind of a religious movement. And I think a lot of it's geared towards actually, there's an awful lot of unhappy young men out there. And that's one of the things. I just wrote an article, a chapter for a book, and for an evangelical press. And I said, it's kind of weird for me, a 55-year-old man to tell basically young evangelicals, and I'm a Roman Catholic to boot, telling them to go to seminary so that they can go out and basically save young men from political and religious extremism, or political extremism and from anti-Semitism. I think that people are casting about for essentially a sense of meaning or a transcendent purpose. And that's one of the things that is really bothersome to me is that I think at one point these mainline churches were effective at providing people with a sense of a larger purpose and provided people with the type of dignity they needed to kind of make their way through the world without damaging other people. And but I think that the Great Awakening, you know, it may not be, it may not go in the direction that we want it. One of the things that I've heard and haven't read too closely about was is that when religious belief essentially collapsed in early 20th century, over the course of one generation in Russia, that was what paved the way for the communist overthrow of the Tsar. And not that I'm a big fan of the Tsar. And so I think that's kind of what's going on. And I don't think that the Catholic Church is in a position, frankly, to kind of respond to this because of the priest abuse scandal. And that's a frightening thing. The mainline church isn't really in a position to do that because I think they've kind of abandoned their original purposes that they were established for. And maybe the evangelicals can pull it off, but I interestingly enough, I think that one group that might actually do pretty well is Muslim leaders and Muslim congregations here in the United States, because there's a lot of young kids that want to get out from underneath the burden of being, you know, considered a white male oppressor. And one way to do that, from what some of the stuff that I've read, indicates to convert to Islam. And what it does is that it essentially gets you away from the burdens of Western civilization, the burden of guilt that has been projected onto Western civilization by an awful lot of folks like Edward Said. So I think, yeah, we are ready for a great awakening, but I think it's an open question of who's going to be able to take advantage of that open field, so to speak.
Great. Okay, I have many follow-up questions, which I will keep to myself. So,
okay,
we can get to that. Not a worry. Okay, so I mean, if we have time, we can always circle back. But let me read some of the questions that we have from the audience, Dexter, and let's see if we can tackle some of them as well. I'll save my questions, you know, to the end as well. So Scott Ahrens is asking, you know, more in depth about the concept of the replacement theology, you know, and its validity. So if God is a liar, then replacement theology has contributed to the demise of the mainstream church. And he's also wanting you to kind of address the issue of the factor of LGBTQ clergy and promoting LGBTQ marriages. Is an abandonment to biblical principles and part of a demise that you see in the churches. And so what are your thoughts about those two elements, which we can tackle a little bit?
I think, first of all, I'll deal with both of those questions as directly as I can. One of the things about Judaism is that it can make sense without Christianity. But Christianity cannot make sense without Judaism, and that's always been kind of a fraught issue for them. And the thing is that if God changed his mind about the Jewish people, then what's to stop him from changing his mind about his Christian worshipers? And what's to stop the next round of supersessionism from taking place? And I want to thank a friend of mine by the name of Yale Zussman, who is a political scientist trained from MIT, who's talked to me a lot about that. And so the thing is that's one of the reasons why, it's oddly enough, there are strains of supersessionism or replacement theology in the evangelical community. But at the same time, they look at the promises to the Jewish people or to the Israelites in the Bible, and they say, yeah, they're still in force. So that's kind of a break against the supersessionism. The political supersessionism is really what I think is dominant in the mainline, is that essentially they think that ultimately for them, the scandal of particularity plays itself out in their politics. They want everyone to essentially be equal, everyone to be happy. And this notion that somehow, and they don't want anybody to be tribal. And that basically puts the Jewish people kind of in the hot spot. And what they're looking for is a utopian world and they promote a utopian worldview about how violence and conflict can be avoided if you only just do the right things or come up with or engage in pacifism. The problem is that Jewish and Israeli history disconfirms that belief. And so what it does is that Israel is a disconfirmation of a lot of deeply held political and quasi-theological beliefs held by the mainline community. And that's one factor why they go after Israel. Now, as far as the LGBTQ issue, there are a lot of deep, what happened in the mainline was is that people came up to their pastor and said, my kid is gay. What do I do? And that was really what happened. I think what happened was is that we saw after and the Stonewall riots is more of a symbol of what happened. But what happened was is that once gays and lesbians started to come out of the closet as a result of the liberation movements that we saw in the 1960s, essentially it became an issue of theodicy. Theodicy, and you know, like, would be God be so unjust so as to basically condemn those people to suffering and living in the closet, so to speak? I think that's how it played out. And the thing is, though, is that, and I'm going to kind of steal a page from Yuri Slezkind, who wrote The Jewish Century. He's written a number of books, and that was the one book that I read of his that was very powerful. He said towards the end of that text is that for most people, the pursuit of happiness is basically pursuing a relationship with somebody from the opposite sex, having children and basically raising them and making and looking out for the interest of your children after they're born. And he said that's basically an exclusionary or tribal type of behavior. And there's no sort of revolution that you can do to basically overcome that aspect of the human condition. And so what I think has happened is that one of the reasons why evangelicals, for the most part, seem to be doing better and maybe not, and they're suffering some of the same issues associated with secularism, is that there's still an emphasis on basically forming men and women, and men in particular, to basically essentially like become husbands and fathers, and so that they can become part of the middle class. And the thing is that that's going to sound really bourgeois for a lot of people. But essentially, if you look at it, religious practice has been a tremendous engine for the middle class for a long time. This is, if you want to enter into the middle class, one of the things that you do if you were in one of the lower classes is, you know, if you're in living in poverty, is to join an evangelical church that makes significant demands, ethical demands and demands on your time and your behavior. And what happens is that, and it's been pretty well documented, and Joseph Bottom mentioned this, but and it's been also written about by other sociologists of religion, people end up becoming part of the middle class. And I think this is really one of the bigger issues that we're dealing with. This is that the institutions that have essentially helped the middle class in the United States, for example, churches, they've kind of, you know, stopped thinking about the centrality of those folks, you know, of like the nuclear family, so to speak, and the conventional nuclear family. And I don't want to promote hostility towards gays and lesbians are people in the LGBTQ community. But what I want to say is that there are that straight people, they need formation. Okay, that I don't know how else to put it, so that they can live useful and purposeful lives. And I think that the churches that have done provided that formation are less likely to attack Israel, to be honest with you, because that's what their focus is. You know, Richard Rubenstein talked about how congregations and congregational life in both the Christian and Jewish world is geared towards the family. And what we, you know, and I think that once people start to go back towards that, we're going to, I think, maybe see some level of restoration. But that I think, so I look at it as more of an abandonment of the middle class. And by the way, I feel the same thing attitude towards the land-grant universities in the United States. The land-grant universities and the institutions that were founded as a result of the legislation, the Morrill Act in 1867, they were tremendous engines of growth for the middle class. They gave people the skills and worldview necessary to be, you know, be able to participate in a modern economy. But now we have a large number of grievance studies programs, if you, for lack of a better word, that are, many of them are centered around hostility towards Israel, or that basically undermine the ability of people to function in a modern economy. And so that's bothersome, because whenever you see people who can't function properly in the society in which they live, you're probably going to see an uptick of anti-Semitism. So I hope I didn't go on.
It's all good. You know, there are no short questions, short answers or questions here, and obviously very enlightening and very important. I'm going to try to combine two questions here, given the fact that, again, these are not simple or short questions to these very complex topics. So both B.B. Gertesman and our friend, and our other friend, Ernie Sternberg, are asking, about, the comparison to the parts of the Reform Judaism, similar to what you've been mentioning in the Protestant denominations. Is there Reform post-Judaism? Is there post-Protestantism and post-Christianity, related to, that segment that is the way it sees Zionism in Israel that we've been seeing growing in some of these more progressive circles? I mean, have you compared and contrasted that? I know you started to talk about the comparison between Judaism and Christianity, but maybe you want to talk a little bit about what you're seeing within the specifically the Reform movement and that street.
I'll be honest with you, I tried to police my side of the street, which is Christianity, and I think I think that an awful lot of the same factors that I have outlined in American mainline Protestantism are patently evident in Reform Judaism as well. And the thing is, I'm worried about that because, frankly, I care about the continued success and welfare of the Jewish people. And, a few months ago or late last year, it was before the lockdown sometime, I spoke at a synagogue up in New Hampshire, and somebody took a picture of the people there. And I realized that I was the youngest person in the room, and I'm the speed limit. I'm 55. And I was like, that's not good. Where are the young people? And so what I have seen is a certain falling away, and I see a lot of people who are struggling against that and are the exceptions that prove the rule. But I worry that basically the trend towards secularism has really kind of overwhelmed a lot of religious communities in the United States, including Judaism. And the thing is that was it Charles Taylor that wrote A Secular Age? And I haven't finished that book. But the thing is that you've got Rodney Stark's The Triumph of Faith. And I think that one way or another, faith is going to come back into play. It's just, what are the tenets of that faith going to be? Is it going to be a totalitarian faith like communism? Or is it going to be a quasi-religious movement like Nazism or some form of fascism? And for all of the problems that our religious traditions bring to the fore, they're better than political politics playing themselves out as religious beliefs. And, because ultimately they have we are held accountable by a higher transcendent God. And here I am making the case for faith, but the thing is that even on a pragmatic level, but I think that's really the case that I'm going to make. I think we're in trouble on a number of fronts, and I hope that we can figure out a way to correct it.
Well, that's definitely, an issue that, Alex and I have been writing and tackling as well. I mean, there is a lot of similarities in that regard, as far as, and especially you're seeing a growth of the within progressive liberal circles, as far as, you know, groups like Jewish Voices for Peace and others, you know, regarding the kind of the I'm Jewish but mentality, you know, and this kind of separation that plays out here as far as Judaism and Israel, you know, so which is also part of, you know, this phenomenon that you're observing these days. So again, there's a lot of similarities there. Let me move on also to, you know, so a few more questions here, so we try to get to everybody. Ben Pollack is asking, how can individual Jews conduct pro-Jewish and pro-Israel outreach into the mainline churches? I mean, this is something you've been writing and talking about and doing, so maybe share some of your experience there as well.
Well, I think one of the things is that they need to stay away from the national leaders, because they're usually the people who get the goods, the good stuff as a result of the BDS movement, and then and try to connect with the people in the pews, which is a lot harder than it looks and sounds. There is a YouTube video of a local church in Connecticut that was in. That Peter McCary, who's one of the people that engineered the anti-Israel propaganda in the UCC, and I tangled with him over the years, he spoke at a local church, and they didn't get the very beginning of it. But one of the interesting things was is that it was clear that the people in the pews, the average churchgoer in these denominations, weren't buying what he had to say, and they asked some very challenging questions. But because Peter McCary had the microphone, well, he had the ability to essentially squash that. And because the pastor, and I don't want to go into too much detail because it's been a long time, but the thing is, another problem is that the pastors in the local churches kind of rely on the people in the mid-level and the upper-level reaches of these denominations for access to pulpits if they need to change their jobs or if they want to advance in their careers. So what you have to do is you have to talk to the people who pay the freight, and you have to tell them what's going on about the Arab-Israeli conflict, and you have to figure out a way to essentially like convey to them that they're not telling the truth about the conflict. The problem, and one of the things that I've read in passing is that the local people in these churches, they can put up with a lot of craziness from their leaders. But the one thing that they can't tolerate is being embarrassed by the leaders of their denominations on a national level. And so if there are people who are important to them, Jews or other folks who are important to them in the larger community, and you can say, look, your leaders and the activists associated with your church are making things worse in the Holy Land by hindering normalization efforts between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that's a big deal. And if you can get write letters to the local newspaper and say, what does the local church think about what their national people are saying? The thing is that the people who go to these national assemblies are self-selectors. And what that means is that, and they are kind of picked also by the people who run the show at the national assemblies. And so they're not going to pick troublemakers. They're not going to pick pro-Zionist troublemakers to attend their events. And so, but what once you start basically making it clear for the local pastors that the people in the pews can't stand this stuff anymore, they will start to send a message up to their national leaders that this isn't any good for the church.
So a good segue to, you know, that, and thank you for that. You know, really, you know, you spoke in your presentation about Niebuhr, and I will also add, you know, people like Franklin Littell and others who fought, in the churches. Is there any younger gen? Apropos, you know, your comment about the demographics. Are there any younger Niebuhrs or Littells or whatnot that you've identified going around that, you know, that, you know, there could be more collaboration, that are basically, you know, kind of raising the flag and kind of raising awareness and questions about what's going on? I mean, is that something you're seeing, or is there kind of a blind, for lack of a better term, orthodoxy in all of this, where nobody wants to, you know, unearth or unpack any of these issues?
That's I don't know. my first instinct is to say, no, there's no Niebuhr on the horizon. But there are some people who, you know, particularly within the Presbyterians, there's a group called Presbyterians for Middle East Peace that has struggled to fight against it. And I don't mean to, but the thing is, and I don't, one of the problems that I have seen with the pro-Israel community in all of the mainline churches is that oftentimes they kind of accept that a lot of the premises about the Arab-Israeli conflict that the anti-Israel folks put forth, such as Israel is more powerful and therefore is, has a greater obligation to make peace than the Palestinians, despite the fact that history indicates that whatever concessions the Israelis offer, the Palestinians will pocket without making any concessions or changes in their own. And the problem is that, and this is going to sound somewhat personally critical, but, you know, the thing was, is that Niebuhr had a genuine religious experience, okay, when he was young, and then he became an intellectual. And I think that an awful lot of the people who go into the clergy these days, they kind of have an intellectual experience first, and then they have, the religious stuff or the religious experience kind of comes in afterwards. And so I think this is really one of the difficulties that we have is that essentially, I don't think, and this is going to be really critical, and it's going to get me in trouble and maybe canceled, but I don't think that the best and brightest are going in to become mainline Protestant ministers and theologians. And like William Sloan Coffin back in the day in the 1960s may not agree with his politics or his agenda, but he had a certain fire in the belly, and he had wheels upstairs. He was a pretty smart guy. And he was intellectually ambitious, and he was spiritually, to a certain extent, on fire. I don't see the ambition or the religious fire in the belly on the part of anybody with, and maybe that's too broad a brush, and I'm going to beg forgiveness for people who are offended by it, but I don't see that. And that's a terrible loss, because if you don't have the religious fire in the belly, if you don't, then what are you going to do? Are you're going to basically kind of be a careerist. And, you know, that's one of the things that I think is going on is that there may be people that have concerns about what their churches are doing, but they're not going to pull a Jonathan Edwards. They're not going to say, okay, I'm going to go into the trench of the Death Star and basically fire the last shot at this system of evil. And I don't mean to, and that may not be the right metaphor to use, but I don't see the people as committed. They'll speak truth to power when they can go to the West Bank and have everybody fawn all over them, but they're not necessarily going to do anything to upset the apple cart in their own churches and say, look, what we're doing isn't working.
Right. Thank you for that. Let me shift, there's another question that came in from Charles Feynman. This shifting a little bit of the larger kind of the global scene. He's asking, what are Protestant church doing in other Western societies, for example, in Canada and the UK, regarding supersessionism and BDS? And what are Catholic societies doing in the United States and elsewhere that you could maybe want to talk about? Well, I mean, you addressed a lot of what's going on in the U.S., yeah. But, what's going on, on the global scene, similar or different, that we can work together, not work together, or, that things that we need to be addressed there.
Okay, well, I think the North Atlantic West is... The Protestantism that we see, or the Protestant stands we take, are essentially the evangelicals largely support Israel, but they're being attacked and undermined to a certain extent by Palestinian Christian activism. And so we see, and also the mainliners, the equivalent of the mainliners in like the UK and Canada is about the same. A lot of anti-Israel propaganda. But then in the global south, I think, we're looking at a growth of evangelicals and also, what's the word I'm looking for? The charismatic movement, that, and some of them speak in tongues, and they have, one of the things is that I had an enormous amount of contempt and hostility towards evangelicals before I started doing this work. And then one of the things that I discovered as a result of my pro-Israel activism is that when I went to their churches, I found that, look, they had a genuine sense that life is worth living. And that's one of the reasons why the charismatics and the are doing well in the South, is because those churches promote that notion. Reinhold Niebuhr said, look, the natural religion, one of the most important aspects of it is that it promotes a sense of optimism about life. And, and so those churches in the global South that are doing that, they're largely pro-Israel. Okay. The churches in the North Atlantic West, where we're going through these cultural and civilizational doldrums, I think, they're anti-Israel. And so it's like, and this is one of the things that I found was that a lot of the evangelicals that I met, they were just happier people than the mainliners. It's that simple. I know that's a very broad brush, but they were more optimistic about life. They had a greater sense of purpose, and they had a stronger religious faith. So that's, I think, the dichotomy that we're dealing with. And so the North Atlantic West, where we're dealing with cultural doldrums, so to speak, and in Europe, a lot of anti-Zionism in the what we would consider the establishment or mainline churches, greater support for Israel in the evangelical churches, and in the global South, I think we're doing a lot better for support for Israel.
Great. Thank you for that. And important to note. A question, just shifting a little bit more, I know, and I guess this will be our last question for the day. I know, we haven't gotten to everything, but we're trying our best. And again, if we don't get to your question today, you can always email us at bdsmonitor@skme.org, and obviously we'll continue the conversation. So I apologize in advance. Andrew Lim has a question, and again, this, I guess I'll add, he wants to know about the what's going on, the situation in the Black churches in America. And I will also add, and I know you've done some work on this as well, the connection, of course, to Black Lives Matter, and how is all this affecting the kind of a snowball effect that you're seeing now with regard to what's happening in those churches?
Well, I think a lot of the, I'm not an expert on the Black churches, but I think that there's a similar dichotomy that we see between the mainline and the evangelical communities as well. The Black Lives Matter, which kind of is more of the Jeremiah Wright, they're pretty hostile towards Israel. And the person who replaced him, Reverend Otis at Trinity UCC in Chicago, has basically signed on with the whole BLM narrative. And the reason why that is important, I think, is because they are kind of using the same tactics that were used to delegitimize Israel, to delegitimize the United States and America in general. And so they're going to be hostile towards Israel. But as far as the African American churches, there's still, I think, a reservoir of support for Israel. In parts of that community, largely because of the Jewish support for the civil rights movement in the United States. But the one area that I don't think that people have made much headway with is the impact of, frankly, jihad on Christians in Africa. But I think that may change. The problem is that that's going to have to be endogenous to the African-American community to itself. That's going to have to be an issue that they decide on their own is important to them. And it's not going to be something that outside activists, like white guys such as myself, are going to be able to say, hey, why aren't you doing more about this? That has to be something that they care about. And I think over the long haul, that's probably going to be a factor, because people are going to realize that the violence against Christians in Africa is in many respects motivated by the same hostility that generates violence against Israel in the Middle East. And the thing is that the UAE And I'll end it with this, is that the normalization between Israel and the UAE is going to actually take some of the heat off, or I think going to deflate some of the anti-Zionist impulse in some quarters, because people are going to be able to say, look, you guys are more anti-Israel than the Arabs are. What's your problem? And don't you think that these people in the Middle East know what's in their interest better than you? So thank you for listening to me, everyone.
No, that's great. Really, Dexter, you know, superb and really enlightening, and a lot of complexity. You know, we know that the Jewish community is complex. Obviously, the Christian community is as complex, you know, trying to unearth and see how all of this is weaved in. So, I mean, you know, definitely, I think there's you opened everybody's eyes and ears to a lot of the problems that we've been seeing and observing. And obviously, I want to thank you. I mean, you've been a shining light on exposing these issues, and thank you for all the good work you've been doing, you know, to tackle these issues. You know, we need a village, you know, and all of us who are tackling the topic of BDS, this is a critical aspect that needs to be addressed and tackled. So I really want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. I want to thank everybody again for joining us this afternoon. I know Alex Jaffe had to leave to another talk, so I thank him, as always, for being with us. I want to thank Dr. Bob Shulman for supporting our talks on these issues. And again, we will continue the conversation next week. Notices will be going out later on this afternoon as we continue the conversation. And Dexter, we hope we can bring you back to continue the conversation at a later date as well. So I thank you all around.
Thank you so much.
Everybody have a great afternoon. Stay safe and healthy, and we will talk soon.